Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another LCI Green Room live stream. Live screen. Gosh, it's been a long day. I do apologize during the stream if I go to blow my nose a few times. My wife is somewhere around 5 months pregnant, and she's in full nesting mode and stirred up dust all over the house. So my allergies are on the fritz, and I'm hyped up on allergy medicine. So we're going to have a good time here nonetheless. I am Jacob Winograd. I'm host of the Biblical Anarchy podcast here on the Libertarian Christian Institute's Christians for Liberty network. So you all should know who I am by now. LCI Green Room's been out for a couple months, and we're here to just bring you a bunch of conversations with different libertarians from different parts of the movement, and just get to know them more, talk about what they're doing, just talk about philosophy, politics, current events, everything that's going on. So gotten good feedback on this new show so far. And tonight's guest, although I've talked to her many times on my other shows, this will be her first time here in the Green Room, and that is Mrs. Angela McArdle, chair of the Libertarian National Party. So Angela, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. I've been waiting to do this for a little bit, kind of waiting for the right time to kind of do a state of the LP catch up here before we get to the national convention in DC. I don't know why my wife and I just keep on timing things out where she's pregnant around national convention time. So we got to get on a different cycle for the next one so I can actually go to it. But anyway, so let's get into what we're here to talk about tonight, which is a lot. In lieu of just a lot of things going around social media, there's a lot of hubbub on stuff going on with the LP, stuff going on with you, stuff going on in anticipation of the DC convention, where we're going to nominate the presidential candidate that's going to represent the Libertarian Party. So as always, the libertarians are on social media, and they are loud, and they are arguing. And so we're going to, do some exercise, and perhaps futile exercises, in trying to bring some truth and some sanity to the madness. I want to start off by, first of all, I should give you a chance to just give yourself a brief reintroduction to people. I mean, people probably know who you are, but you're more than just a mindless drone who's chairing this herd of cats that is the Libertarian Party. You're also a person and a mom, and people should get to know the person behind the position. So why don't you take a minute here just to introduce yourself, give a little bit of background, you can do your come to Libertarian story, the abridged version, and just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, it's a long story, but my name is Angela. I'm the chair of the National Libertarian Party. We relocated to Texas from California, which is where, when we found out we were going to have a baby, we moved. During the lockdowns, I was the chair of LA County's Libertarian Party, and we worked aggressively to overturn the vaccine mandate in the city of LA, which is a 4.5 million person city. It's no joke. It's a lot of work to put out a referendum, or an initiative, and overturn a law. And we did it successfully. We got it overturned before it even went to the ballot, which is really awesome. And one of the other things that I worked on is, I decided that I was going to run for the national chair position in response to the National Libertarian Party's failure to rebuke, lockdowns and mandates. I don't disavow things. I don't decry. I don't condemn. I don't actually think that that's particularly helpful. It doesn't move the needle, but making a statement that, you oppose a horrendous thing that the government is doing, and you want to encourage people to, rise up against it, do what you can to overturn it, that probably would have been really helpful coming from the National Party. And that didn't happen. So, fast forward now, I got elected. I am the chair of the National Party, and we're getting ready for a convention. I've been a libertarian, or at least a small L libertarian, my entire adult life. And I got active in the party in a meaningful way in 2016. I'd been doing medical freedom activism prior to that, working on cannabis legalization efforts in California. So I've been very, very politically active for quite a while. And I continue to do so. So that's a little bit about me.
Good, good. So, yeah, I mean, I remember actually the first time I think I saw something that you did was you did the debate for if libertarians should vote for, I guess back then it would have been Trump, Biden, or Jorgensen. I think you were part of that. Part of that debate, which you did well on. And then, of course, you also then returned to do a debate at the Soho Forum against, what's his name?
Ilias Doman.
Yeah, a guy from Cato who, he makes the people at Reason that I don't like look like libertarian saints.
Yeah.
So, you've always had a hand in what's going on around the liberty movement, and I supported you back for chair when you ran. Full disclaimer: Libertarian Christian Institute, nonprofit. We don't make political endorsements as an organization, but I'm my own person, and so people who know me know that I threw my hat in the ring for the Mises Caucus over the last few years. I was a state organizer for a long time, helped facilitate the Mises Caucus takeover here in Pennsylvania, which assisted in them taking over nationally. And that was in the Reno convention back in 2022. So we're coming up on, the end of your first term after being put in there. And of course, like the Mises Caucus, pitched the idea of taking over the Libertarian Party to make it libertarian again. Largely a lot of us got involved for things that you just mentioned, which was that it seemed like a lot of libertarians and then libertarians who were running the party just were seemingly silent on the most important issues. You didn't see a lot of posts about war. You saw next to nothing. And then you saw next to nothing for a while regarding lockdowns. And then when they finally, because I know the prior people there get really upset if they say, "Oh, that's not true. We talked about lockdowns." It's like, yeah, you waited until the end of summer.
It was one year.
Yeah.
It was a 1 year anniversary.
And then you were basically like, well, the government shouldn't do this, but you better get your vaccines and put your mask on anyway, because that's just the right thing to do, don't you know? And I was like, ugh. So the messaging seemed like it'd be a problem. The strategy and long-term vision of the party seemed to be lacking. I've often described it as step one, run as many libertarians as possible anywhere and everywhere. Step two, Step three, libertarianism in our lifetime. Not a great plan, as the, put that meme up there if I had it ready to go, Tony Stark from Avengers. So we're 2 years into it now, and so people are sort of like evaluating where we are, where things are in the LP after 2 years of, pretty much Mises Caucus leadership at national and across many of the state affiliates as well. I wanted to kind of start off by reviewing sort of the past 2 years, and then we'll kind of bring it into the present day. So, I remember post Reno, post the takeover, there was, of course, like an immediate surge in membership, immediate surge in money coming in. I think one of the first projects that started to get worked on and that came to fruition probably 6 months later was the Rage Against the War Machine rally. So, in that like first 6 months and leading up to the rally, what was that transition like? What kind of challenges did you guys immediately run into once the changing of the guard happened? And you can mix in here some, one of the goals I have for this podcast is I think there's a lot of people who don't understand how the LNC works. And so, having conversations about that and explaining as much as it is possible, inner machinations of stuff like that and how staffing and the board and all that interact will be useful as this conversation continues. But yeah, go ahead and explain that initial takeover up to the Rage Against the War Machine rally.
Sure. So, we took over, and then we had a series of events coming up, things happening, Freedom Fest. At that point, thankfully, plans had been set for Freedom Fest, but the scheduling, most of it, with the exception of my talk, had already been planned and was out of my control. So like the content of the main stage talk that staff did, you know, it was not totally gelling with our vision. It wasn't gelling at all. You know? So right at Freedom Fest, on the way out the door, we had staffers there engaging in acts of sabotage. And, you know, one of them, it was her last day, was telling people the party's been taken over by racists, stay away from it, telling people not to donate to us, like immediately. And this is the middle of July. So that was a challenge. We had some people quit, which was good because that means that I didn't have to do layoffs. And we had some people stick around, and some of those people were really solid. Some were not. Some are still with us. Love them to death. Some have since parted ways, and I don't think they're sucky people. So it was a very mixed bag, and trying to sort through who you should work with, who you should not, you know, who is talented, who is like, maybe really an awesome, cool person, but this isn't a good fit for them. It's like, spent a lot of time working on that. One of the things that I was really passionate about, like the thing that I said, we're going to implement this, we're going to act on it, we're going to do it, was something I put together called Project Cicero. And it was to essentially resuscitate Project Archimedes. And so for those of you who are history or, you know, like mythological buffs, you could look up Cicero and Archimedes and figure that one out. But the LP in the late 90s had Project Archimedes, which was about getting membership numbers up. And there was a whole strategy that they did, and that was the highest our membership numbers had ever been. It was a little bit costly, but it was effective. And I think it was very good for the party. And I wanted to recreate it. So I did a ton of research. I poured through LPedia. I read like every old staff report I could find, figured out who did what went right, what went wrong, you know, and put this whole thing together and put stretch goals for us and was like, you know, we're going to jam on this. Like we're going to purchase data. We're going to do X, Y, and Z to do outreach and reach people. And then right after we passed this, I believe it was the same meeting, there was sort of like an ambush, you know, motion by someone on the board who was, you know, like well-meaning and not a hater, but doesn't share vision with us, to have the national party support fully support Civi CRM. So anybody who has been on a board of directors and has like professional board experience knows how completely insane it is to have a volunteer board of directors vote on what type of software your paid staff uses to implement their daily tasks. It's a pathology. I am proud to say that I have exorcised it from the current administration. I had to drive it out like a demon, and it took me 2 years. I do not have some sort of emotional animosity towards a piece of software. I do not have that. It is software, right? But other people had very strong emotional attachments to this piece of software. And what happened when the board adopted this, and by the way, I passed the gavel and I argued against it and I was very concerned, right, with what was going on. What happened is, in addition to a whole bunch of technical problems that I will, you know, tell you about when you're ready for me to do a deep dive on that, it pulled all of staff's firepower and operations off of growing membership. And this is something in particular that I don't feel like I've iterated like nearly enough. You can be your organization, any organization can be operations focused, or you can be sales/fundraising focused. Or if you're a huge, huge organization, you can be both, like IBM, Microsoft, you know, Apple, giant organizations that are very focused on process, but also sales. But for a small organization like us, we can't do both. And so it completely crippled our ability to focus our attention and energy on new members. You know, staff had to be 100% focused on CRM, this migration, all this data stuff. And it created a waterfall effect that I personally feel that most people, including a lot of people on the board, still don't fully recognize, because they haven't taken the time to really like look into, you know, case studies in other organizations that had similar problems. Reach out to someone with decades of board of director experience and ask them like, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? And that's where we started to really encounter some challenges.
Right. So, I mean, and it's not as though like anybody from any faction within the Libertarian Party was looking at people running for chair or looking at people running for vice chair or at large positions or anything and going like, well, you know, what are your experiences in tech and understanding, like, you know, like being an expert in, you know, data compiling and data migration and, you know, the keeping of records of people's financial information and tokens from, and it's like there's all this stuff that goes into it that it, like I've looked into this enough that like I have a cursory understanding of it, but I'm by no means an expert. And you know, like you have IT people for that, and just from like an outsider's perspective looking in, and I'll pose this kind of as a question, it seems to me like what I would say plausibly happened is that there was a miscommunication that might have been born partly out of a misunderstanding and partly also out of people not wanting to make certain changes, but it led to the board making a decision on, you know, on like moving where you know, you guys stored information on members and stuff like that, and you weren't prepared for, you know, what challenges and risks were going to be associated with that task. But then like once you did it, and then you have to face the consequences. And, you know,
and they were very bad. They were very bad consequences. So it created a waterfall effect of problems that grew and grew and grew, right? So first of all, this migration from Razor's Edge to Civi CRM failed. We lost a bunch of credit card information. So our recurring revenue took a hit, and staff that was against it at the time estimated it at $44,000 of recurring revenue. And staff and contractors that were for it said, oh, there's no way it could be that much. It might be $4,000. Well, I look at the data and the dollars, and it sure seems a heck of a lot closer to 44,000. So that happened right off the bat. In addition to that, during this process, there were some very grave technical errors, and it's impossible to know for certain who did what and who messed it up. But things happened that broke the CRM in a pretty profound way, and the quality of our data continued to degrade. So for example, I'm sure this has happened to people who are watching. Send out a mailer. So, you know, first staff became paralyzed and said, well, we can't do anything because our data is destroyed. And at a certain point, I had to step in and, you know, kind of break the paralysis and say, we're going to do it, even though it's going to suck. We're going to try, right? So let's say we send a mailer out to 5,000 people. 10%, maybe more. 10% is quite a high margin of error, by the way. The membership dates are wrong. So I'm saying, hey, Jacob, we love your support. We miss you. It's time to renew. And you're like, I renewed like 3 months ago. Why are you sending me this? This is weird. So, you know, that's a problem. And then there was, you know, little bits of Band-Aid code here and there, like little boo scripts would pop up and run, and it would recategorize membership, right, change dates.
Because Civi is like an open source, like basically like,
yes,
it was almost like, again, this is not my area of expertise, but just trying to put it in layman terms, it was like, rather than using something that is like its own proprietary software, Civi was like open source, like we were trying to make our own custom, you know, made server.
And it was not designed for this, you know. And
right.
It just was.
And with a lot of different people working on it and you know, not having consistency in the way things were coded and stored and not set up in a way that they would easily transfer from Civi to a new
documentation.
Right.
No documentation, no software development lifecycle. So what that means is, you know, we're a political party. We also service like 30 plus other political parties. We have to have a software development lifecycle if we are going to develop software. How long does it take? Where do we test things? Like, we need a separate, and our IS committee has graciously fixed a lot of this since then. But like, we can't just do a thing, press the red button and hope it goes well. Like, we need a separate little, you know, like laboratory to test things and make sure that they don't break. So we had to come up with all of that afterwards, which was very time consuming, especially considering that we amassed such a massive amount of technical debt in the whole time. So, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot, and I completely acknowledge, and it is a huge pain point for me, is we have accumulated terrible customer service. Because when we started the migration, that means everybody who was a state affiliate or a county affiliate, whatever, who needed help with their Civi CRM. Normally national, you know, would go in and help. Oh, I need to put, I know this happened in Pennsylvania. They needed a convention website stuff updated. Well, we can't do that right now. We're very busy working on the migration. So, well, first of all, that's bad customer service. And that's why we have poor relationships with our affiliates. So right off the bat, that's a problem. Second of all those tickets piled up and piled up and piled up. And we had like 100 help tickets. It was just like, we're never going to get to it. And so at a certain point, staff is just, they become so weary from it. They're just totally desensitized. They're like, oh, okay, well, you know what? There's still 60 people who are mad at me and think I suck and hate my guts. Whatever.
Well, so you did unilaterally decide to do this, Angela, right? Yes. Like you basically said, screw the board. They don't have a say. I'm deciding to do this despite all the warnings about how bad. No, that's the opposite of what happened. The right.
Yeah. It's like some people on the board did vote against it. Due to their
sure,
credit,
sure.
Know, Todd and Andrew. And a lot of them have since come around and said, you know, like I thought I made, you know, the best decision I could with the information I had at the time. I see now that it was a wrong decision. So
right. But this is, it's important. Like, and I feel like people need to realize this. It's like, A, these were circumstances that like no one at the current LNC, I mean, I guess maybe a couple, yeah. But like largely the leadership of the current LNC, no one's responsible for the fact that the membership data was held in two different places. And one of them was this weird Frankenstein of different, you know, people working on it and different coding and things like that. And, you know, there's at least a reasonable argument to be made that like you guys wanted to consolidate things on something that was easier to use and easier to keep up with. And like hindsight's 20/20, like people can easily say, oh, you should have done it this way. It's like, yeah, well, you know, give me a time machine. Otherwise, like, you know, but that, I mean, I think, you know, the thing that I also want to say is that there's not only the money lost from any, you know, data that was lost that you then had to wait to follow up with those people and try to get them, you know, re-signed up for reoccurring donorship, mm-hmm. but in that meantime you're losing out on money, but then there's the opportunity cost of just all the time and energy that went into fixing that. But like, and I'm sure, you know, this isn't stuff that we have a bunch of people listening right now, and to some extent it's like, you know, on a Saturday night no one exactly is, you know, usually like, I want to get on a podcast and listen to, you know, like an hour about like data management going on at the Libertarian Party, right? It's like, this isn't like the stuff that is, you know, the super sexy stuff that people want to think about, but this is politics. Like, this is stuff that parties have to, you know, political parties and organizations have to be able to do. I mean, really, you know, not just parties, but like nonprofits, you know, PACs, anything. They gotta find ways to manage their data and their memberships and people's financial information and records. And you know, and then if people want to, you know, it's important, right? So we're going through and describing things that led to here. And you know, if people want to complain about membership being down, people want to complain about comparing the finances of the party from now to then, it's a multivariate equation, right? To just say like, you know, because some people I see are going around and trying to paint a narrative that just like, well, the Mises caucus took over and then basically they lost all this money because people just like got up and quit and canceled their memberships. And like, sure, I guess some did that. But to act like there's not other things such as this data thing played a huge role is just not to be presenting the whole picture.
There's three significant things, right? So dramatic loss in recurring revenue, partly from the failed migration, but also from errors, you know, potentially acts of sabotage that were done to our CRM as some people exited the organization. It's no joke. That's pretty significant. And then, you know, there's opportunity loss. There's CRM. There's also the massive walk away, you know, and hate campaign is like, it is pretty intense and pretty severe.
And I want to ask you, so you're currently on the, you know, when you became chair of the party, you stepped down from your prior position within the Mises Caucus. But I mean, I could speak from my experience, but I'll ask for you to speak it to yours. When you were with the Mises Caucus and since then, from, you know, just watching what the Mises Caucus does and promotes, have you ever seen the Mises Caucus tell people that they should not, you know, even in states where there's not Mises Caucus candidates or officers, or before the Mises Caucus took over, you know, was there ever any massive, like, you know, cancel your memberships and don't be involved and don't donate to your parties and things like that?
Never. I could think of one person in particular who would whine and say, I'm not donating to National, and remember constantly busting his chops. Literally one person can I think of in the state of California who had that attitude. It was always give to the party, give to the party. That none of this is possible if we're not supporting the, you know, the host nation, the host organization.
Yeah. Yep. So now, I mean, and I think a lot of people upped their donations and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like, listen, like, you know, people can fluctuate their donations. Other thing is, like, listen, it's not like the economy has been getting better. You know, I mean, I was a Mises Caucus member and organizer, and I had to reduce my donations to everything just because, like, eggs were $20 a box for a while. It's like things were crazy. I have four kids to feed.
Yep.
There is a question in the audience, just to try to, you know, as we're maybe put the nail in this CRM thing. Is there evidence of sabotage with the CRM, or is it just more like mismanagement and like a bunch of, you know, clumsy attempts to try to fix things and things like it, you know, more?
I think if you were to go to a trial on it, you would have to present all of the evidence in totality and ask a jury to decide if you thought it was enough to be, you know, by a preponderance of the evidence, acts of sabotage. The extent to which things are messed up with, coupled with the way people left and the attitudes they had and the timing of it, is, I don't know how it's not sabotage if you hold yourself out to be competent in this particular field. The other third thing I forgot to mention earlier was, you know, like the data breaches and the theft of data from our organization. Like, that's a pretty significant thing too, when you have hater organizations who've absconded with your resources and they're going around and asking people to donate to them and not to you very specifically. And I know, because I make donor calls. Like, I've spoken with people about it. But
yeah,
I mean, this is so, you know, I work in litigation. Toxic mold. We'll use that as an example. People get very, very sick from black mold in their house. Aspergillus. Hives all over your body. I've had it before. Hives all over your body, respiratory issues, nervous system attack. And what do you do? Like, what does it appear to the obvious person? You live in your home. You got mold. It's a rental. You asked your landlord to fix it. He didn't. You got sick. This is so easy. Open, shut, case closed. What does defense counsel do? They're like, well, you know, did you ever have an allergic reaction to shellfish as a child? You know, you could do the same thing with the CRM. Everything seemed to be working. And then all of a sudden it wasn't when people left. And right after this botched migration and all of this hate campaigns. Okay. You know, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and it's covered in feathers.
Yeah. And at the very least, I mean, there's a reasonable debate to be had there from the sounds of what you're saying, but the end result's the same. Like, whether it was malice or incompetence,
there was gross incompetence, because you don't Band-Aid code something over and over again with no discernible record of what you've done and no documentation. Like, that's just completely wrong.
Now, so let's paint a little picture here. What is, you know, the, when you took over and then like to now, because I'm sure it's decreased to some extent, but like what's the total amount of staff that the LNC employs around about.
I think we probably have around 10 people on staff.
Right. So, and then the, you know, in terms of the staffing issues, you know, and stuff that people have noticed and that you kind of alluded to, walkaways, things like that. And then, you know, the other component here being the LNC board, the XCOM itself, excuse me. They, you know, it's not like any one person here is in total control. And people might say, well, if you're getting poor results from someone, well, then if it's staff, well, then fire them and rehire someone who's better for the job. Or if it's like someone in a committee or someone who was elected, well, then either, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, there are mechanisms to take care of that too. But there's a problem, right? Because one, I think a lot of Mises Caucus people were sort of in the mindset of, well, everyone is shouting at us saying that like our plan, once we, you know, once the Mises Caucus takes over, is to just purge everybody. And so there's like, you know, an incentive to be like, well, you know, we don't want to do that. And to be fair, like, you know, I never had to, I always told people when I was an organizer, I was like, you know, I'll work with anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to be part of the Mises Caucus. If you're calling me a Nazi and doxing me and my family, we might have a problem working together. And yeah, that's happened several times. And, you know, I guess, you know, I'll just go off here a little bit. I mean, again, I'll just like repeat it ad nauseum. You know, I'm representing me here, not the Institute. The Institute makes no endorsements. The Institute doesn't tell you what to do in terms of your vote or your dollar, other than asking you to donate it to us as a nonprofit if you want. But I joined the party and I joined the caucus, and I, as a Christian, thought, wow, there's people fighting. Let me try to be a peacemaker in this. Let me try to bring sides together. But there are, like, you know, what I encountered was that within the party, there was a few different camps. There was the Mises Caucus people. There are people who were uncaucused, and a lot of them, you know, were great people, great libertarians, great volunteers, great workers. And then there's this other group of people that literally, like, when I say that I was doxxed, when I say that people made death threats against me and my family, when I say people came after me and called me a Nazi and also like made smears against my father and stuff like that, and started calling my dad a thief and a crook. And I mean, just there's a group of people who, because of political motivations, which you would think, you know, like if I was entering the GOP or the Democratic Party, I might expect this, but you'd think with libertarians joining the Libertarian Party, you wouldn't run into this. But there were these nasty people. And I think we don't always do a good job of just being honest about that.
Yeah.
And you know,
because it reflects poorly on libertarians and the ideology that we're trying to get out there. Like, it's the way that they behave, it's completely incongruent with the philosophical notions that they allegedly subscribe to and that we also subscribe to. And it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
To try to pull people into the party and say, join it. Like, libertarians are awesome. And then you have this trash over here that's stinking up the room. Yeah, it's a problem. And, you know, I think, you know, this is probably something where, I don't know, there's some Christian implications and I haven't like fully grasped and articulated this yet, but there is something in me, and it's a weakness politically, there's something in me that I cannot stoop to the same tactics that they do. Like, lie, cheat, and steal are off the table for me, and I can't bring myself to do it. And thinking about it in my head makes me queasy. Like, I just, it's too, ugh. And with our internal political opposition, that's not the problem. Like, we have a hater board member right now, just like lying through his teeth in a Signal group chat saying that we had to reduce the room rates for convention. And it's just totally made up. But, you know, there are people who are totally comfortable behaving that way.
Right. Well, and someone just said, how does any of this glorify Jesus? I mean, I would counter, how does doxing people, how does making threats against their family, how does people, I mean, I'll be specific. They said that they published my address. They had a Google map picture of my house, and they were publishing it on multiple groups, including groups that said that they, you know, like, I live close enough to Philadelphia. They were saying they were going to send Philadelphia Antifa to my house to shoot up my house, shoot up my wife and kids. Yeah, that, like, so what, to glorify Jesus, I should just be like, oh, thank you. Like, I don't know. Like, you know what? You've changed my mind. I don't think the Mises Caucus should be in charge of the party. I think it should be you reasonable people over here. And don't get me wrong, there was bad behavior on the Mises Caucus side sometime, and I would call that out. But I never saw anyone on my side saying, let's dock these people and send terrorists after them.
Right. It's totally nuts. And, you know, like, that's an interesting question. Like, how does this, like, I assume talking about it, glorify Jesus? This is a struggle that the board has had. And it's one of the reasons that I'm, you know, kind of breaking silence about everything that's gone on, is I think that we've been very paralyzed when it comes to reputation defense. And, you know, I typically, like, I want to stay above it. I want to stay out of the fray. I want to be the magnanimous leader. And it just doesn't work that way. Because when you're hounded by an aggressive hate campaign and people are lying about you, at a certain point, it's your responsibility as a leader of the organization and a person involved to come out and say, that's not what happened. This is the truth.
Right. I mean,
and love, I have to do that.
So the same person said, what are you doing to exemplify enemy love in these circumstances? Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. So 100%. At some point, you know, listen, I'm not going to respond in kind. I'm not going to, you know,
correct.
Listen, Romans 12 says you cannot, do not be overcome by evil. So if someone doxes me or makes threats against me, I don't respond in kind, but I will say what the truth is. And I will, just like Jesus would expose the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, I think it is fair to expose the wrongdoing and the lies and the hypocrisy of other people. And listen, that's a universal standard. There are many times, Angela will tell you this, Michael Heiss will tell you this, Jeff Douglas will tell you this, Dave Smith will tell you this. Anytime I have disagreed with people in the Mises Caucus, they know it.
Right.
I speak my mind and say, I'm not down with this. I don't like that. And sometimes there have even been public instances. So it's not, but again, it's not the same. There's, I don't agree with this political strategy, and these people are making death threats against my family, right, and death threats against other people's family and things like that, you know, going after Joshua Smith's kids and things like that. Like, there's just this long list of things that, you know, made it said, you know what? All right, there's this group of people who I'm, you know, as a Christian, love them, pray for them, politically not going to work with them.
Well, love them like Jesus, and a far away distance, you know, interdimensional.
And as far as this plays into the LP, to bring it back to that, yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people on the board, because this whole thing came up when I was saying, like, well, people might be saying, well, if you're blaming staff and you're blaming incompetency, why didn't you just fire them and get better people? I mean, one, I think the LP is like any other organization where it's like, you know, finding libertarians in the right skill sets to do the jobs you need. Yep. I mean, it's not like there's, you know, a billion of us to pull from. And secondly, yeah, I think people were kind of incentivized to be like, well, we don't want to be too heavy handed.
Yep.
So it's like, so the criticisms can't be both you were going to be too heavy handed and also why weren't you more heavy handed?
Well, and then sometimes it's just as simple as, well, who do you replace that person with? You know, because now I'm in a staff position for free, which, believe it or not, some people are critical of me saving the organization like $100,000 a year. And it's not because I was excited to do more work, like, by any stretch of the imagination. It's just, this is what happens sometimes. You know, like, did I interview and look for replacements? Yes. Was there someone that we could afford who was going to carry out our vision and had management experience? No. it's a problem. So the reality is I'm not faced, like I don't set up for work every day and get faced with obvious choice, bad choice. Like it's not good, bad. It's usually bad and worse. Yeah. And they're both bad choices. And it takes me a little bit of time to figure out which one is worse. And I don't always get it right. Sometimes it takes me a couple of times and that sucks, you know, and to a certain extent,
oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's totally on me, but it is not an easy thing. It requires a lot of judgment and you have to have a very thick skin because no matter what you do, people are going to criticize you because there is no like perfect path.
No. And yeah, I mean, there's plenty of times I've gotten the balance wrong. There's been times where I got too jaded and had to take a step back and actually apologize to even people that I was not aligned with and be like, you know what? I responded out of anger to what you were doing to me, but I hold myself to a higher standard and I fell short of that. But again, there's a difference between forgiving people who persecute you and then being like, well, let's work together anyway. Like that's different. Like Jesus tells us to forgive those who persecute us, bless them. But he doesn't say that we need to tie ourselves at the hips to people who are being abusive. Yeah. That doesn't bring glory to Christ to tie yourself to the hips of people who are abusing us. So, you know, let's you guys dealt with that data migration problem. You've had ongoing issues with staff.
Theft of data.
Despite all that, you guys were still able to do some things. Like there was the Rage Against the War Machine rally, which I know there's a second one that you know is in the works for the future
September.
When you guys can get you know. And you know, I think that this is also something that's weird. That and I want to ask you this. Like I want to know how it is that we can be both alt-right Nazis, but also how dare we work with communists?
That's called diplomacy.
Because listen, I think, you know, one of the things I loved about the Mises Caucus platform, again, loved about, I'm talking about the ideas here from my LCI position. The idea of issue coalitions, of working with anybody to do good, regardless of where they come from on the political spectrum. And, you know, for all the talk that I would hear about how the Mises Caucus is this weird far-right group, I was like, you know what? They seem more than any other group in the Liberty Movement willing to work with right and left.
100%.
From like, you know, almost some, I mean, and don't get me wrong, there were times where I was a little critical of certain alliances. I was like, I don't know about this guy, but like, I would rather have an LP that's willing to like, you know, reach across the aisles and try to work with people and build these, different political alliances than one that's just content to kind of like play T-ball by themselves. And so I think Rage Against the War Machine is a good example of that where, you know, we were able to get, a huge rally in DC, to protest the war machine, to protest the military and industrial complex. So I mean, what went into building that and you know, what are, you know, I know there's other examples too of things beyond that where you, the work you and the LMC have been able to do has broadened the LP, not just nationally, but state affiliates as well, to start working with different groups and even different political parties at times and candidates from different parties.
So Will Hobson, who is the chair of the Oregon LP, connected me with Nick Brana, who is the chair of the People's Party. Will is a Mises Caucus guy who came from the left. He's very passionate about the anti-war movement and, you know, like, peace and diplomacy are at the forefront of his mind. And Nick and I think we had a live stream early on and we just talked about like our areas of alignment. And it was really cool to discover a group of people on the left who were anti-lockdown, anti-mandate, anti-Federal Reserve. So don't think that people on the left are hopeless when it comes to economics, you know, didn't have Trump derangement syndrome. They're like, I don't really care about that. And the way people react about that is disturbing. And super anti-war. And so we started collaborating on an event and it grew and grew and grew. And we involved some people from the Schiller Institute, which a lot of people's heads exploded over that. They don't like the Schiller Institute, but I'll tell you, those people have been persecuted by the CIA in the past. And they have also been smeared with the alt-right Nazi stuff unjustly. And so they were very sympathetic to us. They were like, we see you. We know what you're going through. We know that it's all BS and lies. And we support you and we want to work with you. And more groups grew and joined us. And like we made lasting relationships that way. We're working together on another rally. It blew my mind to be at that event. We brought together, you know, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and Tulsi Gabbard and Max Blumenthal, like people from all over the political spectrum. There were people there in BLM shirts, wearing masks, hugging members of our party because, you know, it became more than just opposing war. And I think, you know, it was significant because there were sister rallies that kicked off all over the globe. It was a worldwide movement. And it reignited the anti-war movement and got people politically charged. And we, the Libertarian Party, we got to be at the very forefront of it. But more so than that, the people there, like we became a microcosm of what we wanted to see globally because we all set aside our differences. And we were like, I see the humanity in you. And I see you like for the authentic human being, like individual that you are. And I love and like embrace you.
That sounds Christ-like now, Angela, like looking at people for their humanity and not just their political alliances.
Absolutely.
It was a
beautiful moment. Like it was just like one of my most cherished memories, I think, was, you know, it's not like being on stage and announcing it. I mean, that was really cool too. But the after party and seeing like and really experiencing what we created.
Also, let me just say something from my experience within the Mises Caucus. There were some people that actually were not like, listen, just to, like, we'll give the devil his due. There were, I would say a small minority, but still there were some that were not happy that we were working with people on the left.
For sure.
A lot of those people left or they got over it.
Correct.
So like, you know, cause I know some people say that, you know, there are some people who, I guess we'll say we're not being intellectually honest if we don't acknowledge that. Like, I mean, I'll acknowledge it, but like any large group of people, there's people. I mean,
we're not the Borg. We're not like a literal hive.
You're right.
People
right.
Are
exactly. So anyway, but that's just a minor point to bring up. But I mean, I've always I came from the left. I mean, I was a Bernie bro back in 2015. And then when the left got Trump derangement syndrome and threw away the few values that they had, you know, I became politically homeless and then found libertarianism. And I know there's plenty of people on the left that can still be reached. You know, that's where
definitely.
And they still exist. It's the Glenn Greenwalds of the world and the Jimmy Dores of the world. And, you know, there's guys like Ben Burgess. There's so many out there that are still either people we can actually make libertarian or at least people we can align with on important issues like this. You know, the leftists that want to, you know, lock us in our homes and who want to usher in, you know, the woke corporate dystopia that the left sold their soul to support, a little bit harder to find issues to align with them with. So, you know, the left and right aren't monoliths any more than any other group are either. So, but yeah, I think, you know, and then there's, I know you're the slate right now. Hannah Goodman from Colorado is running to be the vice chair, and she's had some interesting experiences with you know, kind of like trying to do some coalition building. Yep. And some kind of political dealing and stuff over there in Colorado, which there's probably opportunities to scale that up to the national level as well. And let's talk a little bit about that as far as you're comfortable sharing, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it.
I'm excited to work with Hannah because of her particular experience there. I did a lot of rubbing elbows at CPAC, you know, and I think that people on the right are very interested in working with us. So when I say people on the right, I don't mean like establishment GOP types. I mean people who are conservative, they're generally Trump supporters, and they're skeptical of their own political party. And I think that's perfect. That's right for working with us. My general assessment is that they're going to support Donald Trump for president. They're interested in what we're doing. They would like to support and see us succeed at the local level, which to me is like 100% like in alignment with our strategy, go ahead and do your thing, you know, at the presidential level. I hear this, by the way, when I call donors sometimes too. Most important election in our lifetime stuff. I'm like, do you have anything that you could give to support like a local candidate to reduce taxes? And they're like, yeah, I'll give you $1,000. Dude, amazing. They want to see us take out like the Soros DAs, right? And that's like, that's what I'm here for. Supporting candidates at the local level. That is exactly what the Mises Caucus is all about. That's what I got elected to do, is to carry out decentralized revolution. You know, I want to do that. I think it's like, I think it's so critical. And it's perfect to work with people on the right in this way, and to say, you know, I'm not going to press you on the presidential race, but can you work with me on the local level? We're going to get support.
And I think so some people are hearing this and they think this is a betrayal of libertarianism, a betrayal of the party, that it's selling out principles for political expediency. I mean, listen, I host the Biblical Anarchy podcast. In my heart of hearts, I'm a Christian. So I live for Christ. This is Easter weekend. Tomorrow is the celebration of Jesus's, you know, resurrection and conquering death and sin and all that, and his declaration of him and as king, and that his kingdom is the one and only true kingdom. And I live for that. And because of that, a consequence of that is, you know, philosophically, I'm compelled to be an anarchist in the world. And I think that, you know, libertarian anarchism, anarcho-capitalism, these are all, you know, true political conclusions that map onto what the Bible teaches. It's the whole premise of like what my podcast and political activism is. Mm-hmm. But so it's like, you know, if anyone wants to challenge my anarchist cred as if I don't fully believe in these principles, you know, they're welcome to, but they're going to have a hard time. And I know you're also a principled, you know, ANCAP and a Christian, and would largely agree with the things I said. This is politics. This is like, we're not going to listen. Like, the Rothbard button doesn't exist. I wish it did. Right. I would break my thumb pressing that button, but we don't have that option. Instead, we have to work with what we're given. And, you know, we can choose to be the most principled people sitting in the back of the car, you know, yelling and crying, or we can see what we can do to try to get, you know, our hand or even like a finger on the wheel, or try to like, you know, tap the navigation system or tap the brakes or put it in, like, let's do something to have some influence on the political apparatus in the country. And if that means that the Libertarian Party in the national and state affiliates are coming up with strategies to like put the, you know, least bad or most tolerable, you know, Republicans or Democrats at national positions, but then like we're getting local level victories where we can actually start decentralizing things and, you know, doing things like nullifying federal laws and, you know, making Second Amendment sanctuaries and, you know,
sure,
cannabis sanctuaries and things like that. Like, I don't know. Like, is that? I don't understand why people would at least not admit that maybe that's not their preferred strategy, but that's not a crazy, like, out of left field, just completely like unprincipled strategy or betrayal of libertarianism.
Well, let me break some of this down. So people are hysterical and unrealistic. And it's because, you know, the Libertarian Party, if not the entire movement, did gain a lot of libertine, do what thou wilt types. And they don't like rules. And it's very self-absorbed behavior. I think that we had a culture in the past of very entitled, self-absorbed people with very unrealistic expectations. And the reality is, like, I don't have to endorse Republicans or do anything like that. There are thousands of elected positions in this country. We cannot run people in every election. We literally can't. We ran like 800 people in 2018, and it was kind of a disaster. We overtaxed ourselves. We didn't have enough campaign volunteers. We spent a whole lot of money on it. We didn't win a lot of elections. Like, it wasn't a fruitful strategy. So there's no reason to not just like say, hey, you know what? You're right. We don't have to run anyone in that race. We could run someone over here because we don't have a person for every race. And when it comes to taking money, maybe from donors who don't 100% sort your cause, okay, would you take, if you're running your county affiliate and you're like, I need $100 to table at XYZ event or $500, right? And I don't have enough, like, you know, we're a small affiliate. There's four of us. If your dad gave you $50, you're going to say no, dad, because you're not a registered dues paying libertarian. I'm not going to take your money. Like, this is so absurd. Like, we're going to take donations where we get them and we're going to do our thing. And this is just normal behavior.
Yeah, I agree. I think
abnormal. Abnormal to purity test to the point where you wouldn't take like a donation from someone who supported you, even though they weren't all the way bought in.
Yeah, well, there's and you and I know we've talked privately behind the scenes about some of the there's a lot of libertarians that apply all different types of purity tests in different arenas, and some of them go off into weird spaces we're not going to talk about here.
No.
And we'll just leave it at that. In the interest of time, I want to move on to some current stuff that's happening right now. So apparently the LP is actually the haters were right all along. And one of our state affiliates is actually just a total Russian asset. Do I have that right? Or, this FBI report
so much to parse through. I think Karen Ann Harlos is doing a show about it tonight. So, the FBI reached out Friday when all this was it Friday or Thursday? I don't know. The FBI reached out very recently. I had so many things happen and, told us that they had to talk to us, you know, about something urgent about our social media. And so our secretary answered the phone and was like, no, I'm not talking to you. Talk to our attorney. She didn't even give his phone number. She gave his name and was like, you know, look it up. Good luck. They called him immediately because they're the FBI and they have everyone's phone number. They called him immediately on his cell phone. Creepy. And, you know, started going over some stuff with him about our Facebook page being compromised, our Facebook account being compromised by a hostile foreign government. That's the term, hostile foreign government. They wouldn't tell us which government. They wouldn't define what compromised is. There were a couple of IP addresses that they threw out. That was it. They wouldn't tell us like why, what was happening, just compromised. And, you know, he called me and told me about it. And I'd heard from Karen Ann too, you know, while I was on the phone in another meeting, I'm like, yeah, what is going on?
You're like, am I being punked? What's going on here?
So I talked to him and I'm like, are we being scammed? Is someone from Nigeria calling, pretending to be the FBI, trying to get her. So he called the field office directly to find out. I was like, let's double check to make sure that we're not just being punked, right? And the field office immediately connected him to the agent in question who called us. And then she sent him a letter, you know, stating it on FBI letterhead. And I have an appointment to talk with them again on Monday. So, you know, that's where we're at. And in the meantime, I reached out to a friend who's in intelligence, who is not a Democrat. And he said, Angela, this is what the Biden administration is doing. And it's all over social media recently. They pumped tons of money into the DOJ to crack down on disinformation and political like dissent because of the whole Russian election interference hoax and all of that. And they're going to harass and try to shut down as many social media accounts as possible. The only way to protect yourself is to go public. Like, that's the only way right now. So that's what we did. You know, we took that advice and we're going to continue to do so because what they're trying to do is to say you're compromised. Therefore we got to shut down your communications apparatuses. So I say it not in vain. Thank God.
Crushing me, Angela. I thought the intelligence agencies were there to look out for us and protect our rights.
Yeah, they're gaining intelligence, all right. But seriously, thank the one true God that Elon Musk did take over Twitter and tell these guys to pound sand. because whatever happens, at least our Twitter account is still safe. Like, they're going to come for every third party, their political opposition. You know, they throw FEC complaints at Kennedy. They throw criminal and civil allegations at Donald Trump. And so far, they're just trying to shut down our social media. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
They want one party rule. Like, they want one party rule.
No, I think that's right. I think, you know, this... it's creepy. I mean, it's honestly creepy. And I mean, for the Christian audience that I speak to who aren't libertarians, like, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, I guess maybe sometimes it sounds like, you know, tinfoil hat stuff, but no, like, the deep state's real. Like, the uniparty's a thing, and they like power. They will do anything they can to hold on to power. I mean, this shouldn't be new. Like, I mean, like, right now my church is going through the book of 1 Samuel, and it's like, look at all the crazy things Saul did to try to hold on to power. Yes. And going after David. It's like, yeah, no, people in power can go crazy trying to hold on to that power. And our government, our state, and elected officials, and really the problem is all the unelected bureaucrats who are in our government and in these intelligence agencies that, you know, I'm not a fan of Trump, but it's just lunacy to not look at the fact, you know, look at the evidence and realize that they committed to taking out Trump.
Totally. They don't like that.
Yeah.
He wasn't a part of their system. You're not supposed to make it this far. Out the door with you. You know, and they want to fire a warning shot to everyone else too. And make an example of him, just like they did with Alex Jones. You know, you can dislike the person a whole lot, but we got to be smart enough to, like, learn the lesson and watch out for that.
Yeah. So, you know, trying to, you know, bring things to a close here, the, you know, we just went through a lot. Like, we tried to cover as much as we can about the past 2 years, and, you know, there's still stuff that we glossed over rather than giving a lot of time to. I mean, it's been a crazy whirlwind. And I think, you know, question I would have for you is, you know, should the delegates in D.C. decide to give you a second term? You know, what is going to continue, and what, you know, like, what things have, do you think that you and the, you know, the LNC have done right that you hope to continue to do, that you hope to expand? And then what are the lessons you've learned, mistakes that, you know, that, you know, were made, or just things that you didn't know that you know now, where you're going to do things differently in the second term?
I underestimated the hater drama by, you know, like, that was a serious miscalculation. I did not know how aggressively they would come for us and try to destroy us. So I will be handling that differently, you know, as I've started to handle it differently now. You know, this is part of that. I want to say that, like, you know, so financially we need money. So out there, people, please donate. One of the best things you can do for the party right now is to go purchase a convention package. Go purchase a convention package. It's lnc2024.com. If you can't afford a package, please get an a la carte lunch option. If you cannot afford that, get the $49 comedy night, especially like the 30th and the 31st, today and tomorrow before the end of the month. It'll super help us out. Aside from being in a financial tight spot right now, the party is doing awesome work. And I think that has not been talked about nearly enough. Like, the party is doing great. We have Voter Gravity, which is a complete game changer tool. If you care about candidates, if you're one of those people who's like, the party should only exist to get candidates elected, then you and or whatever candidate you're volunteering for should get Voter Gravity. You email me at votergravity@lp.org and I get you signed up. It can be as little as $50 a month for your race. That's something that would cost thousands of dollars. That right there, the financial worth in there is worth more than, like, we would make in 2 years. It's $100,000 or more. It's like an incredible savings. Get in there and get it. I'm about to release template professional level WordPress websites for candidates. I've gone back and forth with one of our staffers started it. He's like way overwhelmed. So I passed it to a contractor. I went over it with them Friday. It's beautiful. And there's three different styles that you can choose for your main page, so you can customize it a little bit. I'm going to go in and I'm going to finish some of the copy for them. You put in your photo. You put in information about your race. You download this thing, and we're going to have it so that it's easy. We'll have a tutorial for you. You download it and connect it to your server, and you're done. You don't have to pay an arm and a leg for a professional website, and you don't have to pay $25 for a garbage, hideous GoDaddy, like, build your own website. So please do that. We've got amazing stuff. We've got the anti-war coalition work. We've got, you know, the Tennessee has been doing this Second Amendment coalition work. We've been supporting Defend the Guard. Like, we've been doing some amazing stuff, and we're going to continue to do that. I also, due to sabotage, and that's a whole nother story, I didn't get to roll it out yet, but we purchased a data append that was completely wealth screened. And once we get it into our new CRM, we also have a new CRM, by the way, and we also have a new LP.org website that's coming too. Once we get that data plugged in, like, it's going to be a financial game changer for us. Like, we have a whole lot of tools. My frustration is that I have been stalled for many months by massive acts of sabotage, delay, all of that. But we are so close to, like, getting everything across the finish line and teeing us up for, like, an awesome, incredible presidential season and an amazing next 2 years. So that's some of the stuff that you're going to see.
And it's important context to, you know, speak to briefly here that, you know, people like to act like there's, and don't get me wrong, there are some things that are unique to the last 2 years. There's also things that aren't. Like, the LNC has gone through financial difficulties before. Like, yeah. You know, before the last convention, I know that the prior administration had to take out loans and things to cover costs and whatnot. And, you know, and the, you know, you this current term, you know, you guys were actually doing very well financially, you know, 3 or 4 months ago. You know, things go through peaks and valleys, and challenges, you know, come up, and, you know, but it doesn't have to be like, you know, I think some people are trying to, I don't know, like, do what they can to cast everything that's bad in the worst possible light.
Yes.
And then cast everything that's good in the least charitable light possible, downplay it as if it's either not that good or just not good at all. I mean, listen, you and I know, we've talked privately. There are things that you've done, that the board's done at the LNC level, things different states have done that, like, you know, I don't always agree, which that should be understandable. Like, you know, find two people who agree on everything, period. Like, that's just common sense.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that you would admit that, like, you know, like you just said, like, you know, things I didn't quite, you know, didn't, things I underestimated, things that I plan to do better. So, you know, at this point in time, you know, I won't tell people how to vote if they're going to be delegates at DC, but I will say that if your thought is that, well, this is all just Angela's fault. I don't know. Like, again, I don't think Angela was voted in as dictator back in Reno in 2022. There's a lot of moving pieces here. I think a lot of people underestimate the extent to which the Titanic was already sinking. So, you know, I think you guys are doing your best, and have plans to continue moving forward into the future. We got LNC2024.com up there. People want to go to find out more about the convention in DC, where, of course, you know, a lot of stuff's happening, including picking the presidential nominee for this election season. Is there anything else you want to plug, or any, you know, and one thing I wanted to also briefly mention here, because this is also a Christian podcast. Listen, there's something that needs to be said too, which is, I think what this current administration, the LP, has been trying to do is trying to move the LP away from the stuff that I think a lot of Christians are rightly concerned about. They're concerned about this weird progressive woke corporate monster that seems to be infiltrating and soaking up and dominating a lot of institutions. And I will say this, if you're looking to the LP and going, man, I really hope they don't become that, I don't know who is better for the job to make sure that doesn't happen than you and the slate that's running with you. So
we've driven those demons straight out of the party. You won't see it. I mean, one of my goals was to make this organization friendlier to people who are socially conservative and Christians. It doesn't need to be a Christian organization. It needs to be an organization where Christians feel comfortable joining. And I think that we've done a really good job of that.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, well, any final things you wanna plug as we're closing?
This is a really challenging job. It was challenging for people on the board too. So please don't mistake my just general frustration as anger at them. They've been through the ringer, and those of them who've stuck it out, like, I have tremendous appreciation for them. Please purchase your convention package. You can donate at lp.org. If you're not going to the convention, please throw us $5, $10, $25 today and tomorrow. Help us finish strong this month. You can support me at Patreon. But you know what? I'm in it to win it. We're going to have an awesome next couple of years, or I'm going to die trying. Happy Easter.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Happy Easter or Resurrection Sunday or whatever you want to call it. Of course, we have to end here by saying the dog whistle, Christ is King. And, amen to that. Angela, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, everyone who tuned in and listened. And we will talk to you next time.